Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel, and today I'm pleased and honored to have with us Professor Alexander Watson. Professor Watson is professor of history at Goldsmiths University in London. He is the author of a number of well-received and indeed renowned books, one of which garnered him the Wolfson Prize, and the other one the Frankel Prize. And today we are discussing his latest book, The Fortress, Przemysl and the Making of Europe's Bloodlands, published by Basic Books. Welcome, Professor Watson.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you very much for having me on. It's a huge pleasure to be talking to you.
Professor, what is the thesis of your book?
So the book is about a few things. It's about the longest siege of the First World War, the Siege of Przemyśl, which lasted around 180 days. It took place between September, October 1914, went on till March 1915. At its core, that's what it's about. It's about the longest siege of the First World War. But within that, the book also situates this in the greater catastrophe that took place in East Central Europe from 1914 until 1950. And the thesis of the book, the underlying thesis of the book, using this siege to bring this out, is that East Central Europe's catastrophe, where you have genocide and the Holocaust, huge ethnic cleansing in the 1940s, that to understand how East Central Europe breaks down, you have to go back not simply to the start of the Second World War, to the rise of the dictators, or even to the Russian Revolution, to 1917, but actually you've got to go back to the First World War in 1914, that strategies of starvation, brutal fighting, ethnic cleansings already kick off right from the outbreak of the First World War in 1914.
Can you tell us a little bit about the city's history prior to the outbreak of the Great War?
Yeah, sure. So East Central Europe, Przemysl was I wrote this in the book, it was a crossroad of cultures. East Central Europe was a very, very ethnically mixed place for most of its history. In the area that this city is situated, there were Polish-speaking people, Ukrainian-speaking people, lots of Jews, some Germans, the Hungarians and Slovaks weren't that far off either. And Przemysl was built in about 900, so it was founded, the city was founded 1,000 years before my story takes place, in part because it was on hills, it was an easily defensible situation, but also because it was on trade routes, going from east to west and also from south, from Hungary up to the Baltic in the north. So this was a junction. It was a junction place, a place where people's met, people's exchanged, people's moved all the time, and where lots of peoples of different religions and different languages settled. It changed hands a lot of the time through the millennium before my story. It was for a while in kind of Ukrainian hands, the kingdom of Rus, medieval kingdom of Rus. It was in medieval Polish hands. There was a Hungarian king who ruled it briefly. But by my story, by the start of my story, it's in Habsburg hands. It's part of Habsburg Empire, an enormous Central European empire which had 11 languages and about 50, 55 million people living in it. And Przemyśle by that point had become a pretty important provincial city of around 50,000 people. But also around this city, the Habsburg Empire had built a fortress, and Przemyśle had become the Habsburg Empire's main defensive position, its main bastion in the east.
Now, in terms of the fortifications that rang the city, how would you compare them in terms of quality to, I was thinking of particularly two different fortifications. One, of course, is in Belgium, and the second one was the fortifications that Russia maintained until, I believe, in essence, that they let them go or no longer found them usable circa 1910, 1912 in Poland. How would you compare with those two sets of fortifications in terms of quality?
So compared with fortifications in the West, Przemyśle's were less advanced, less well maintained, less updated. One of the problems, fortification building is very, very popular among continental European powers in the late 19th century. Most big land powers build them. Germany has a wave of fortification building in the 1870s. France does too, Belgium and Russia. The problem is all this fortification building starts just at the point at which artillery technology begins to change very, very rapidly, far more rapidly than people are expecting. Guns get heavier, they cease to use black powder and begin to use much more powerful smokeless propellants, which means that you can have projectiles that are bigger and that can fire further. They become, from the 1890s, end of the 1890s, quick-firing as well. So you've got a completely different set of armaments by around 1900, 1910 than you had 30, 40 years earlier in 1870. And that makes all of these very extensive fortifications that all of the great powers, all of the continental powers have built, obsolete. And differing powers, depending on their bank balances and their military priorities, update the fortifications to differing degrees. So France does and Belgium with Liège, France, of course, with Verdun, do update their fortifications. They develop new ways in which to cushion the new heavy shell fire. The Russians don't so much. The Russians' big fortification, they've got a couple of them on the eastern front, Ivanogrod and Novogeorgievsk, today called Modlin. And they aren't updated, and as you say, they are decommissioned. Certainly, Novogeorgievsk is decommissioned, but then hurriedly put back into commission at the First World War. Przemyśle kind of stands in between. It stands between the more advanced fortifications of the West and the decommissioned ones of Russia. There are advances made, and there's constant building and rebuilding up until 1906 in order to try and make this very strong ring of forts. And it's a really, really impressive, visually impressive set of fortifications. The ring, the circumference, about 30 miles in circumference. It's a long stretch of fortifications. But in 1906, a new general staff chief, Konrad von Hötzendorf, is appointed to lead the Habsburg army, and he doesn't have a lot of faith in fortifications. He believes in war of maneuver, and he removes funds from the fortification program, especially on the eastern front. He's still willing to build them on the Italian front. As a result, for the 10 years before the First World War, Przemyśle ceases to be updated. And that's a problem. In 1914, that's a problem. It doesn't have enough food, but also when compared with the latest guns, what the latest guns can do, its forts aren't capable of withstanding them. Anything over about 15-centimeter caliber, and they're expected to collapse. Tests are done, and tests are done by the Habsburg army, and they show pretty categorically that any opponent with the latest ordnance will smash through Przemysl's fortifications very, very quickly.
Can you tell us a little bit more about character, and I suppose in particular the strategic missteps of the K&K Army's Chief of the General Staff, Konrad von Hotzendorf?
Sure. So Konrad, well, I describe him in the book as that most dangerous man, and a romantic who believes himself to be a realist, and that's kind of who Konrad was. He was had a reputation as being a tactical genius, but he had very, very limited experience of war. He'd been a part of some anti-guerrilla campaigns in the 1870s in the Balkans, in Bosnia, but beyond that he had no practical experience of war. But he was nonetheless very widely respected within the Habsburg military. He wrote a book on tactics, which became kind of the must-read for Habsburg officers, but really wasn't updated in the decades between when he wrote it as a staff college instructor and 1914, when war broke out. And of course, with the increasingly powerful armament, his idea that soldiers could attack without artillery, that it was all about morale, it was all about psychology and willpower. These ideas very, very quickly proved disastrous for the Habsburg army on the Eastern Front in 1914. The other thing about him that I make quite a lot of in the book is that he was in love with a woman about half his age. He'd had a previous marriage. He had sons by his previous marriage. His wife had died, and he'd become obsessed with a younger woman, a noble woman called Gina von Reininghaus. And he was very, very keen to impress her. He wanted to marry her, but Austria, very strict Catholic country, very strict divorce laws. She was already married, and he became convinced that he would only be able to marry her and get over these hurdles if he came back a war hero. And you kind of see in the missteps that he makes some of his inability to recognize his mistakes, inability to admit to his mistakes, crucially inability to learn from his mistakes. Some of this is just about his obstinate character, but some of it as well is about fear of if he admits to this stuff, then he's not going to end up with this dream of marrying this woman whom he's obsessed with.
Would you say that he could be characterized as more than unusually incompetent?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, without any doubt whatsoever. I mean, generals, first of all, generals get bad press, and I think a lot of it is unfair. The Germans, the British, you know, and in Britain, there's this very famous saying of lions led by donkeys. The idea that British troops were great, but the generals were terrible and stupid, and that kind of stereotype doesn't really hold in a number of ways for most of these men. They were dealing with a very unfamiliar situation, a new type of industrial war. For sure, people say, yeah, you know, but what about the Russo-Japanese War of 1905, which saw trenches, or even the American Civil War, which, you know, had been, you know, has a good claim to be the world's first industrial war. But nonetheless, for Europeans' experience, even in the modern age, war was something quick, won by decisive maneuver. This was, you know, the hallmark, the model that they're going for is the Franco-Prussian War of 1870-71. There's still a lot of people who expect that war will look like that. So they're dealing with a very, very, very unfamiliar and to a degree unexpected situation. They're grappling with how to use modern armaments effectively, how to get forward effectively in the face of rifles, machine gun fire, and above all, quick-firing artillery. And most of them are willing to adopt technology, are willing to experiment, and they learn. They gradually learn. That's the case in the British Army, it's the case in the German Army, but it doesn't, it consists, it's even the case from 1905 to 1914 in the Russian army, but it doesn't seem to be so in the Habsburg army, which has huge problems learning lessons, analyzing lessons. And part of that is due to the institutional issues within the army itself, but a good part of it is due to Conrad, who continually makes mistake after mistake after mistake, an entirely avoidable mistake that he's already made before. So yeah, I think Conrad is incompetent.
Would it be correct to say of the five great powers who participated in the Great War, the K&K Army was the least prepared of them?
Yes, I think it would be. That wasn't wholly the Habsburg Army. That wasn't wholly the Habsburg Army's fault. One of the reasons why it was less prepared than Germany, France, or Russia was simply that it had a smaller budget. There wasn't the political will to spend large amounts of money on the army as there was in the other major land powers. There wasn't also the money. There wasn't the same wealth or taxation base as in Germany or France, which was made things complicated. And the empire, as I said, had 11 different language groups. There was a lot of pork barrel politics going on in order to attempt to keep all the different nationalities, politicians happy. And that in turn impacted on how much money was left over for the army. So compared with the other major land powers, yes, the Habsburg army was less well prepared. I suppose the other reason, as well as budget, was in terms of training, in terms of its expectations of what war would be like, and that was down to having Conrad as its chief trainer as well as leader, which did it huge damage in 1914 when he had this tactical doctrine that emphasised that willpower alone would get men forward, and that broke up in a hail of fire very, very early on. On the other hand, it was still more prepared than either Italy, whom it later fought, and which had an even lower tax base, and it was actually also more prepared than Britain. That's worth emphasising too. Britain, of course, didn't have a conscript army, it wasn't prepared to fight a large land war, and it ended up manufacturing a mass army, as of course, as you know, did the US, during the war itself. So those would be the exceptions, Italy and Britain, within a European context. But among the major land powers, for sure, the Habsburg army was less well prepared, both in terms of the budget that it had, the equipment as a result, and also intellectually, the ideas about war that Conrad disseminated among his officers.
Can you relate to us briefly the disaster or series of disasters suffered on the battlefield by the K&K army in the beginning, the first weeks of the war, which resulted in the beginning of the siege in late October, early November 1914?
Yeah, sure. So everyone knows that the huge battles that went on the Western Front, and of course the German invasion of Belgium and then France in August and September 1914. But most people in Britain and the US think have much less idea about what went on in the East. And of course, the Eastern Front is much more important in world historical terms. This is the epicenter of the Holocaust. It's the epicenter of ethnic cleansing 30 years later. So if you want to trace that catastrophe back, then you really do need to know about the trauma that went on the Eastern Front in 1914. The initial fighting, the key fighting, the main front, was in a place called Galicia, which today is in southern Poland and Western Ukraine. At that time, it was the most northeasterly province of the Habsburg Empire. And Przemyśl sat right in the middle of it. The fortress sat right in the middle of this province. And it was important that they positioned it there for three reasons. One is that it was defensible. It was on the last high ground before the Russian border. The second reason was that the main rail routes ran through it. And the third reason was that the Habsburg army didn't believe that it would be able to fend Galicia from a Russian invasion, because the border, which was nearly 2,000 kilometers long, a bit over 1,000 miles long, was simply too long to defend. It was too long to station troops along. So the strategy and the reason why Przemyśl was built, why a fortress was built there, was that the army would concentrate around this fortress and then sally out in response to a Russian invasion, regardless of whether it came in the east or whether it came in the north. It gave the Habsburgs a lot of defensive flexibility. What happened in 1914 was that, of course, the Habsburgs fought not just the Russians, but also the Serbs. And Conrad made some major, major mistakes in deploying his army. Firstly, he prioritized deploying towards Serbia, which was, of course, much less frightening opponent than Russia. He wanted to try and defeat Serbia quickly. But it meant that a lot of troops who became desperately needed in the north against Russia first went down south to the Balkans to fight the Serbs, stayed there for a few weeks, and then were transported all the way northwards, if you like, two sides of an immense triangle, arriving too late to take part in anything other than a defeat. So that was one problem. Second problem that he had was that he changed his dispositions at the last minute. So he was going to have a defensive disposition right in the middle of the province, and then he said, no, actually, we'll go for the offense. We'll attack outwards. But by that point, the rail technician said, well, it's too late. We can't unload the troops near the border now. We've got our rail schedule sorted. If we mess around with them, then there will be chaos. So Habsburg troops, although they were initially told to attack northeast, ended up being unloaded from railways in the middle of the province and then having to march all the way up to the borders of the Habsburg Empire, which was many tens of miles, and then head off into Russian territory. And of course, by the time they got into battle, they and their horses were frequently exhausted. The Habsburg army starts with an attack in the northeast, which kind of goes nowhere. Conrad is very angry because the Germans don't help him because they've got their own problems with a Russian invasion of Germany further north. And very quickly, the Russians are able to put their much larger army, they're able to make their numerical superiority felt. The Russians are attacking the province both from the north and from the east. And in the north, there's rough parity of forces. But in the east, without these troops who have been sent to the Balkans, Habsburg soldiers are massively, massively outnumbered. And the result is there's a break-in around the Ukrainian city of it's called today Lviv. At that time, it was the capital of this province. And the Habsburg army in early September is smashed, and I mean really smashed. It's devastated. The casualties are extraordinary. About a third of the men become casualties of some sort just in that first fighting. It's completely, completely horrendous. And the army reels back. It makes an attempt to stand again, amazingly, after what it's been through, and then it's broken through again. And there's a general order to retreat. And in the 90 kilometers between Lviv and Przemyśl, it just streams backwards. It's lost much of its order. Discipline has gone. It's also been infected with cholera and typhus, which have invaded the battlefield. And my book starts by placing the reader on top of a tower in the city of Przemyśl and watching this massive, defeated, devastated force come flooding in disorder right through the city. And that's the position that the Habsburgs found themselves just a month and a half into the First World War, in mid-September. And it was in those circumstances that the fortress that my book is about became the Habsburg Empire's last hope for survival.
So is that the reason why Conrad decided the fortress needed to be defended at all costs?
Yes, that's exactly it. There wasn't anything else. They desperately needed time. He sent out the order in mid-September that the fortress must be defended at all costs, and he took his army back another 200 kilometers, about just over 120 miles, something like that, back further west, where he intended to refill its ranks, to restore discipline, to give it rest. And at this point, there were plenty of reinforcements to be able to him to do that. But he desperately needed to get it back and give it some rest. Otherwise, he was going to lose the whole thing. So it's at this point that absolutely the fortress becomes key to buying that time, which the army desperately, desperately needs to reestablish itself and go back into the fight.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And what were the initial Russian plans to take the fortress, and why did those plans initially fail in October, November 1914?
So it's an incredibly dramatic moment in the war. I mean, it's a massively dramatic moment. It's one of those turning points. You know, if the Russians had taken the fortress in October 1914, most likely the war would have been over by 1915. The Habsburg army would have fallen very, very quickly. That would have left Germany alone, and Germany alone could not have withstood both France and Russia, with, in addition, a new British army in formation. It's a pivotal point. And the person leading the Russian forces, there are three Russian armies around Przemyśle, is General Brusilov, who, I think, if anyone knows anything about the Eastern Front, they've heard of General Brusilov, because, of course, he won this huge victory in 1916 against the Habsburgs. And he's utterly intent on taking the fortress. He says, if we take this, we can open the way up for an invasion of Central Europe. This is what he's telling Stavka, the Russian high command. So he's given the go-ahead to launch an assault. And at the start of October, he draws up his siege artillery. He gets his best units into position. And at the start of October, he launches an all-out attack on the fortress of Przemyśle.
Now, in the book, you go into quite detailed on Russian ethnic cleansing, for lack of a better expression. I suppose at the time, perhaps they would use the expression population removal, in the portions of Galicia that the Russians had occupied in the time span of the book. How would you compare that exercise of state power with what occurred in the region after late 1944, early 1945?
So I think that what we're seeing is the beginnings of brutal imperial practices and modern programs of population change, of, say, population removal and replacement already in 1914. There are a couple of key differences. I'll come to that in a minute, but just to explain what happened. The Russians enter Galicia not simply planning on conquering the province, but actually on changing it. They're not simply interested in the land, if you like, but they are also interested, as you've said, in the population. The Russian Tsar, Nicholas II, talks about creating a Great Russia to the Carpathian Mountains. And what he means by that is simply not just expanding Russia's borders westwards, but also actually literally creating a Great Russia of Russians, turning this region into Russians. Galicia, as I've said, is very ethnically mixed. There are Poles, Ukrainians, and Jews living there. In the east, it's that there are Poles, still plenty of Poles, but the majority population is Ukrainian-speaking, and there are significant numbers of Jews. And the Russians claim eastern Galicia on ethnic grounds. They say this should belong to Russia because these peoples, these non-Polish peoples, Ukrainian-speaking peoples, are actually, the term is used, little Russians. These are a branch of our people. They are little Russians. That's what the imperial Russian army leadership thinks of them as. In fact, the word Ukrainian, because it suggests a separate nation from Russia. And here, of course, in attitudes, we see even some links between then and today with what Putin has been doing in eastern Ukraine. And some of Putin himself has used that term, little Russians, to describe Ukrainians. But the claim is that these are our people. They're not a separate nation. They're certainly not Poles. They shouldn't belong to the House of Empire. These are Russians. And when the Russian army comes in, it does three things. Firstly, in this region, locally, Poles are mostly in charge. There's a lot of autonomy. There's a Polish government, and these people are removed from power. So the Poles are disempowered. Then, secondly, Ukrainians are to be little Russians. So one of the things that happens when the army gets in, it finds out actually that Ukrainians have their own identities, their own religion, the Greek Catholic religion in this region, and their own language. But rather than say, okay, these people are different, the answer to that is, right, okay, so we are going to introduce conversion campaigns to the Russian Orthodox Church. We're going to change over schools so they no longer teach you the Ukrainian language, but instead Ukrainian-speaking children will be taught in Russian. So this is a form of cultural ethnic cleansing, if you like. And then the worst fate is resolved for the province's Jews. There are around 800,000 Jews living in Galicia, and there's no place for them. And one of the things that we see very early on in the Russian invasion is pogroms, a wave of violence, which comes as soon as the Russian army invades. Cossacks, that is mounted Russian troops, attack Jews, humiliate Jews, loot their property. Jewish population, members of the Jewish population are killed, they're harassed, they're persecuted. Then through end of 1914, early 1915, this radicalizes. Jews are accused of being spies, and the army begins to try and force them out. And we have lots of cases of Jews being in large numbers held hostage and moved into Russia as hostages, and also whole communities being moved eastwards as well. And that's ultimately exactly what happens in Przemyśle once it's captured in May 1915. After the city is captured, the entire population of 17,000 Jewish population of 17,000 people is forced eastwards and is cleansed from the region.
So, in fact, this type of population removal is qualitatively quite different than, and this I got from The Ring of Steel, your previous book, the French population removal in Alsace-Lorraine in the beginning of the war. I think actually, from my memory, if my memory is correct, you state in the book that was probably the first population removal of the Great War that French exercise at that point.
I wouldn't say it was qualitatively different. I would say it's quantitatively different. There are larger numbers being moved around. I think it is different from what happens 25 years later in the same region because it's not genocidal. That's an important difference. The Russians aren't actually aiming to exterminate Jews, but they are cleansing them from the region. So there are links in terms of both racism and in terms of thinking about populations in ethnic terms, you know, certain groups of people, nationally defined or ethnically defined, are perceived to be problematic, dangerous, undesirable. That's the first step. And the second step can be, therefore, they have to be moved out, which is what the Russians are doing and what actually the Nazis initially do Or alternatively, they can be exterminated, which is the radicalization that goes on in Nazi policy from 1941 onwards. So there are differences, but there are also, in terms of thinking, in terms of how populations are thought about, and of course in terms of the region itself, which becomes an area of experiment for the Russian Romanov regime, then later the Nazi regime and Stalin's regime. These links are present from 1914 right up and beyond 1945.
Why did the fortress ultimately fall in late March 1915?
Lack of food is the short answer. A lack of food. I mean, the fortress garrison and the fortress population are very interesting. I talk a lot about them in my book. One of the things that I wanted to really bring to readers was, which kind of in coronavirus times feels, well, timely, is the experience of being isolated, the experience of being trapped in a world that had where mobility and globalization were growing. You know, the pre-1914 world was a globalized world. People were very, very mobile. If you just think about the huge numbers of immigrants at that time that were coming to America's shores. This was a world in which people generally had a world vista. They traveled long distances. Communications, of course, were getting much quicker as well, with the telegraph, the beginnings of the telephone, rise of new technology like motor cars as well, and of course then above all railways. And what fascinates me about 1914 is how all this in the summer stops. It just stops. That's it. It stops. The end. The Western world closes down and prepares for war. And Przemyśl, because it's a fortress city, has a particularly intense experience of this right from the beginning of the war. So the book is about isolation. It's about this very sudden change from mobility and globalization right to a sudden point where everything stops. Now, when everything stops, of course, one of the key things that a fortress city needs is food. And there's not enough done to prepare the fortress city, and crucially to provision the fortress city at the start of the war. Even worse, when after the Russians' initial attack in October 1914, the Habsburg army, with its discipline restored and its ranks refilled, sweeps into the city. It's desperately short of food. So as a result, a lot of the provisions that have been stockpiled go then, both in terms of food actually and in terms of munitions, go then to the field army to keep it fighting just outside the city through October 1914, before then at the start of November it retreats and withdraws back westwards. And the result of that is that the city is left without enough food. It's theoretically got enough food for around 3 months, to sustain it for around 3 months. In the end, by through a variety of measures, including eating their own horses, the garrison is able to eke out longer than that, from November right through to March, in around 5 months. By the end of the siege, of course, there's huge malnutrition, there's even starvation. Soldiers are dropping from hunger, dropping from exposure. It becomes a nightmare. The army itself, the garrison, becomes a zombie army. Men are so weak that it takes them hours to get even small distances. And the fortress eventually capitulates because the commander recognizes we don't have enough food. We are not going to get relieved by the Habsburg army, and we have to, you know, we have 3 more days, and we cannot go in any longer.
Why was the subsequent Russian occupation so short? I believe approximately 3 months.
Largely because of the Germans. I mean, one has to think, of course, about this war as being a multi-front war, a multi-theater war. The fortress, city fortress, falls on the 22nd of March 1915. It's then under Russian control until early June, when it's brought back by the Central Powers, and the Central Powers win it back. In January, February, March, the German army isn't in a position to help the Habsburgs retake it, despite the fact that as a result of the huge battles of the autumn, it's become a symbol of prestige, a place which in propaganda terms for the Habsburg Empire holds a similar position that Stalingrad did for the Soviet army in the Second World War, you know, as a mark of resistance, a sign of the power and the readiness of the Habsburg army to see the conflict through to the bitter end. So it's very important to capture it back. But the Germans, the Habsburgs can't do it themselves. Conrad launches three offensives over the Carpathian Mountains in winter, probably the worst fighting that has ever taken place in history, probably even worse than some of the more famous battles on the Eastern Front in the Second World War. This is very high altitude fighting. There's hundreds of thousands of men involved. 600,000 men become casualties, many of them simply through frostbite. And of course, Conrad launches this because over the mountains is, as the bird flies, the shortest way to get to the fortress. But of course, over a mountain range in winter, it's madness. And he's not able to he's not able to do it. The Germans are busy in France and in Belgium. Of course, the Germans hoped that they would defeat France quickly. The plan is at the start of the war to defeat France in 6 weeks. That doesn't happen. They're thwarted at the Battle of the Marne in early September 1914. And then, of course, in the west, the focus of the fighting moves further north to Belgium, to the area around Ypres. And Falkenhayn spends the end of 1914 and early 1915 trying to break through there against the British and the Belgian armies. And he's intent on doing that at that early point, because he's convinced that if he can break through, then he can unlock the Western Front, defeat the Western enemies, and that for Germany is the key to victory. So at this key time for Przemyśl in early 1915, the Germans had no troops to spare. That changes in the early summer with the offensive of Gorlice-Tarnów, which is launched in early May. And that proves to be a massive success. The Germans actually bring over troops down to Galicia to assist the Habsburgs, but the Germans plan and organize the offensive themselves. The Habsburg army, with its incompetent commander, plays very much second fiddle to them. And they break through the Russian lines very, very quickly and start a huge Russian retreat. The Russians lose huge numbers of men. This Gorlice-Tarnów offensive, which takes some techniques from the West, particularly in its use of artillery, proves to be utterly devastating. And the Russians reel backwards, and in the process of that retreat, they also lose the fortress city of Przemyśl.
In the book overall, I think it would be correct to say that the KK army was incompetently led and therefore had dysfunctional results in terms of battlefield performance. Would it be correct to say that, unlike most of the other armies that in the Great War, in terms of the great powers, Russia, France, UK, Germany, even Italy to some extent, there does not appear to have been a positive learning curve for the K&K army? Do you agree with that? And if so, why was that the case?
Well, I'd be a bit wary about ideas of learning curves. I think that in all of the other armies you mentioned, what we see is for sure a process of learning, but it's not by any means a smooth curve. There are mistakes made, sometimes lessons are drawn, but sometimes those mistakes are repeated. We see that with the British Army. We see that with the French Army. Although the German Army, tactically and operationally, is much admired in the literature, we actually see that as well in the case of the German Army too. So, yeah, I wouldn't talk about anything as smooth as a curve, a learning curve, in any case, in the case of any army. I think with the Habsburg Army, The problems are greater, though. I think that is true. Although we also see big problems in the Russian army. And I think it comes from a variety of sources. I think my number one reason would be Conrad. And the fact that, unlike other armies do exchange their major leadership, actually pretty quickly. Joffre is in charge of the French army through 1415-16, but then he's dismissed in favor of Nivelle and then Pétain. So, that changes. The British change their high command pretty quickly in 1915. General French is replaced by General Haig. The Germans, of course, change theirs as well. When commanders don't work out, Moltke, who fails at the Marne, is replaced very quickly by Falkenhayn in 1914, who then in his turn, after Verdun, is replaced in mid-1916 by Hindenburg and Ludendorff. Conrad, by contrast, keeps going through until the spring, early summer of 1917. Despite all of the huge mistakes he's made. So he's a constant menace, if you like, to the Habsburg army's ability to fight well. That said, I think there are other problems too, in fairness to him. The army, compared with its opponents, we've talked about, is less well-equipped in 1914, and it's very, very, very difficult to replace and make good those problems in wartime. And then, of course, the other issue is that the Habsburg army is extraordinarily diverse. And this is something that I had a lot of fun with when I was writing about the garrison of Przemyśle, which had Poles, Ukrainians, Austrian Germans, Hungarians, who, if you have a closer look and have a bit of a probe, turn out often actually to be Romanian or Serbian-speaking soldiers. There are Italian-speaking Tyroleans. There are a fair number of Czech officers. There are Slovaks. And so it goes on. And in the peacetime period, the way that the army had dealt with that diversity was to have officers who could speak their men's language. The problem is that, firstly, the army expands, so there are plenty of reservists who don't necessarily have such a good grasp of the language of the men whom they command. And the second issue is that a lot of those professional officers who, whatever their battlefield tactical capabilities, were very proficient linguists, die. Officers die in huge, huge numbers as a result of Conrad's tactical and operational mistakes in 1914, and they're irreplaceable. And so part of the problem that the Habsburg army has is that it's very, very difficult to train. The Germans improve by, to some degree, dropping formal discipline and encouraging individual initiative, individual willpower, encouraging training in individual in tactics which demand a very high quality of non-commissioned officer as well as officer. And the Habsburgs have much greater problems doing that because of their language difficulties, because of the huge losses they've suffered in 1914, and also because they overall have a much less educated population than does Germany or France. So all of that plays into the tactical problems the Habsburg army has, although Conrad, at the end of the day, has a lot of blood on his hands. In the end, he would be my number one reason for the huge problems that the army has.
So perhaps that explains why one of Conrad's few acknowledged talents was the fact that he himself was a gifted linguist, correct?
Yeah, oh yeah, goodness. I think he spoke something like seven languages fluently. Yeah, he did. I mean, that was as a linguist, he was very, very impressed. As a general, perhaps less so.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from the book, Professor, what would it be?
Can I have two? Would that be all right?
Yes, two would be fine.
Is two okay? All right. So the first one is something that we've talked about, which is thinking about the roots of the horror that befell East Central Europe. That East Central Europe today, Poland, Ukraine, Belarus, the Baltic states, looks entirely different now than it did 100 years ago, because it was the site of the world's greatest tragedy in the middle of last century, with the Holocaust and with the ethnic cleansing. And if we're going to understand that extraordinary process, then the message my book is giving is that it's not enough simply to periodize and think about, well, this is the Second World War, or this is the period of the great dictators with Hitler and Stalin, 28-33. But actually, we need to link that second great catastrophe of the 20th century with 1914, with the First World War, with the first great catastrophe, because it's at this point that it begins. And I think my book makes that very clear. I mean, I'd be thrilled to know what readers make of that argument. But I think so many of the things that we associate with the conflict of 41 to 45, 39 to 45, the brutal fighting, the strategies of starvation, aerial bombardment, and of course, above all, ethnic cleansing. All of these things, although people don't realize it, they appear right from 1914, when a civilization, the world, who people who live in it think, you know, imagine will go on forever, suddenly and dramatically collapses. So that's my first takeaway thing, the links between East Central Europe's catastrophe in mid-century and 1914. The second one is this is a book that's above all about people. It's above all about what it was like to be there, to experience it. It was a fantastically exciting book to write, because I found these great memoirs, great diaries, very, very expressive descriptions of how people felt, how people experienced the process of having perfectly normal, often very, in the case of the officers, bourgeois lives, and then being thrown into this chaos and violence. And I hope that people who read it, readers who read the book, get a sense of what it was like to be there, what it was like to be in a world that seemed to be stable, that seemed to, for sure, there were tensions, but that it was unimaginable that anything could change suddenly. And then in the summer, have all of that swept away and forever, and to be replaced by something more violent, more unimaginably violent, more uncertain, and more lasting for decades than anyone could ever have possibly imagined or expected. In the end, it's a book about the fragility of civilization, and I hope that comes through for readers.
Yes, actually, I think it does very, very well and very topical, given current circumstances the world over in terms of this horrendous virus. With that observation, Professor Watson, I would like to thank you very much for being so kind to speak with us today. This is Charles Cotillo. Thanks for listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thank you, Professor Watson.
Thank you very, very much.